Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And a quick perusal of the front papers will tell you what you probably kind of know already in your bones, which is that as we begin a new Dáil term, it's going to be a scrappy one. So the Sunday Times is leading with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael focus on survival first. And this is Roderick O'Gorman, the Green Party leader, who is shocked that the needs of politics often supersede the needs of good policy and what the government should be doing. He's also saying that the confidence and supply Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil government took no difficult decisions across 3 years, and anything difficult was just bounced. And I saw that in my own department. And he says we're ready to go before Christmas as far as the Greens are concerned. The Business Post: pressure on Harris mounts to call an early election as FG surges. So there's they have a poll today, but they're basically saying that the pressure is growing. If you did a straw poll, I think you might find that of the people who care in the political system, Simon Harris seems to be the only one who wants to keep going into the new year, but that would be unscientific. There's talk here, you may have heard this, of a Valentine's Day election. Sunday Independent has the details of the as yet unpublished Frank Clark report into the death of 16-year-old Aoife Johnston in University Hospital Limerick. The Mirror has a very, very upsetting story for any parent or any human being, really, of 8-year-old Harvey Sherratt, who is has very, very severe scoliosis, and it seems he was removed from a waiting list. It seems it was a miscommunication. You would hope he's back on the waiting list and scheduled for surgery now, but the poor little fella, looks like he really needs it, and he seems to be in a lot of pain a lot of the time. The Sunday World has a story of a taxi driver convicted of a sex assault on a young woman in the back of his cab. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with that Jules Thomas, the ex-partner of deceased murder suspect Ian Bailey, said she would strongly welcome a public inquiry into the unsolved murder of French filmmaker Sophie Toscan du Plantier. And The Sun on Sunday, for those of you who've been keeping up with the marital travails of Eamon Holmes and his now ex-wife, soon to be ex-wife, Ruth Langford, she has hired a fierce divorce lawyer in her marital split from Eamon Holmes. And there's a picture of Eamon Holmes there with the woman who we're told is his new partner. Okay, our panel today to discuss most of those things, maybe not Eamon Holmes, we mightn't get to that. Suzanne Lynch is associate editor with Politico Europe. Louise Byrne is political correspondent with the Irish Mirror. Dan O'Brien is chief economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs. And Aidan Regan is an associate professor at the School of Politics and International Relations in University College Dublin. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Louise, the front of the Sunday Times, Roderick O'Gorman not happy with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. So this is the start of, well, it's not the start of it, but this is it now, is it, for the next while?
Yeah, I think so. And it's quite a scrappy interview from Roderick O'Gorman. And I think a lot of people would say he would have thought that he didn't actually even have this in him. But since he became leader of the Green Party, Roderick O'Gorman has made it very clear that he would prefer to talk to parties like Labour and like the Social Democrats about the prospects of forming a government to come after the next election. But this interview with Hugh O'Connell today, he's not holding back. He was saying that the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have put political survival ahead of good policy making, that the last time that they were in government, or this confidence and supply arrangement as it was called, they made no hard decisions, and the only reason that hard decisions were made this time was because of the Greens being there. And I mean, I think this is really the start of the general election talk, because there's been so much discussion this week about when it is. We haven't really got a clear answer from the Taoiseach whether it's going to be November, whether it's going to be February, whether it's going to be March. He just keeps saying we're going to go full term. And I think there's a lot of discussion going on at the moment about, well, what does full term mean? Does it mean after the budget, like a lot of the Fine Gaelers are saying? Does it mean February? Does it mean March? Roderick O'Gorman saying, well, we're happy to go whenever. We'll be ready for November. So I really do think that this is quite a remarkable interview, really, from Roderick O'Gorman with Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Times.
From your vantage point, no, and we'll stress this is just from your vantage point, but you're up around there and you're talking to people. How are relations across the coalition government at this stage, say between the two main parties and then the Greens also?
It's growing more and more testy, I would say. And I think in the last couple of weeks, what you've seen is the parties getting really annoyed with each other about budget kite flying, which is remarkable because they are all at it. Like, they've all been at it for months. But you had this whole thing over last Sunday's piece in, again, the Sunday Times, actually, with Neil Richmond of Fine Gael saying that he wanted the stamp duty increase for institutional investors. Then you had the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, coming out on Monday, I think it was, basically slapping him down and saying that wasn't a very sensible thing to be saying. You've had this whole row over the land tax. And don't forget, the relationship between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil has changed utterly in the last couple of months with the installation of Simon Harris as Taoiseach. And Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar had worked together for years. They'd known each other very well. They were esteemed, actually, despite all beliefs at the start. They actually got on really, really well, it would appear. And I mean, I'm not saying that the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach
don't. And there was big respect always, it was said, for the no surprises rule.
Yeah, and you know, even speaking to people down at the Fine Gael thinking in Tullamore, it was really spoken about, even though Leo Varadkar is no longer Taoiseach, that relationship that they did have. And there was always this feeling that, you know, Leo Varadkar was never going to stab Micheál Martin in the back. And that's not to say that Simon Harris would or that he's planning to,
no,
but perhaps they're
not
on the same footing as perhaps, you know, Leo and Micheál were. But they've been in power together for a much shorter period of time. So
yeah, but
there is that
is
uncertainty.
Is it also the case that it's inevitable now that it's, is it every man for himself now, every party for himself from here on in?
Well, it seems that way. I mean, Simon Harris is saying there'll be an election for everybody, but I seriously doubt that, to be honest. So, I mean, Roderick O'Gorman is making, I think, very fair points, actually, about the importance of a small party in government. I mean, if you look back over the history of party politics in Ireland over the past 20 or 30 years, it typically took a small party in government with the larger parties to kind of drive a policy agenda, whether it was the Progressive Democrats previously in the early 2000s, with the Greens today over the past few years. He's making the point that smaller parties, I think, are kind of ideologically committed to a certain set of policies and they will drive those policies.
And have a disproportionate amount of power, really, in the situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the other issue, though, may be, the other issue may be that the poll results that are in today's Sunday Business Post actually suggest, I'm reading one headline here, return of coalition minus the Greens most likely outcome. Mm-hmm. So that's the reality facing the Green Party, according to this poll. It suggests, it shows that Social Democrats are doing pretty well. They're up a point, they're at 6%.
Yeah, so well, you know what, just before you continue, why don't I just give the general state of the parties, right? So Fine Gael, according to this, is at 23%, up 2 since their last poll. Sinn Féin is at 18, down 2 since their last poll. Fianna Fáil at 18, down 1 since the last poll. Independents are at 15%, no change. The Green Party down 1 at 4%. The Social Democrats up 1 at 6%, Independent Ireland at 4%, down 1, Labour at 4%, up 1, People Before Profit Solidarity are at 3%, no change, and AIM2 is at 4%, up 1. And that was conducted online between September 5th and 10th with a sample of 1,004 adults, and the margin of error is plus or minus 3%. So there's the science bit. And now have at it.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, if when you look into the detail, I mean, Richard Colwell here analysing the poll results does make the point, for example, with the Social Democrats, yes, they do seem to be performing well in this poll, but sometimes they struggle to make this count in an actual election. So, of course, we don't know how that's going to translate. But I do think we also need to think about that with the Green Party's comments. You know, is this the last hurrah for this coalition government, and particularly that smaller party in the coalition government? At least this poll suggests it might be.
OK, Dan, you picked a piece in the Business Post around the poll. Harris sticks to his guns as Fine Gael widens lead. Colonel Thomas.
No, I didn't.
Okay, go on. Okay, give us your general thoughts on the conversation so far.
Just in terms of opinion polls, I think in recent years, election campaigns have started out with opinion polls and have been radically different results at the end. So there's been a change in Irish politics. It's become much less predictable. Things can go very differently over the course of campaigns. Different issues can take hold. So I think we need to give maybe less emphasis. I'm not saying the polls are wrong. I'm simply saying that what happens in the weeks coming up to elections, we saw it in 2019, 2020, this year, that things are very unpredictable in Irish politics now.
Yeah, and look, there was like a Sinn Féin government was regarded as a dead cert by a lot of people for a time. And also, we've had situations in the past where you get a radically different result in a general election than you got in a local election, which happened just shortly before that. On that, Alison O'Connor has a piece in the Sunday Times. The Greens have strong roots, but the party will wither if Roderick O'Gorman doesn't speak up. Obviously, she didn't realise at that stage that Roderick O'Gorman was rousing himself to speak up. But she talks about everybody stealing each other's clothes a little bit, but Fine Gael are stealing the Greens' clothes on, say, childcare.
Yeah, you see that very clearly. Some might call it a turquoise politics, the mix of green and blue. And Simon Harris has been quite good at that, I think.
I like it, yeah.
I think Simon Harris, he understands where the median voter is at in Ireland, and he's kind of shifting slightly to the left of centre, let's say, slightly, to where Fine Gael would be, kind of continuing the Gareth Fitzgerald route, you might say, a kind of more Christian social democratic pathway. But yeah, he
was
said
there
very...
Was not at the beginning, though, was he not signalling, like, and Fine Gael were in general, a move to more traditional blue shirt values and kind of, you know, like looking after the people who get up early in the morning, all the stuff that Leo Varadkar used to talk about, but kind of... went off then, and migration and stuff like that, more of a right wing kind of.
But we also know that from public opinion and from large scale studies, people typically have a stronger position on law and order than most political parties do. So he's also moving in that direction, I think, in response to that. There's clearly a sense of people want a stronger government response to that. But on the childcare thing, it is interesting because Simon Harris has basically said that he would like to move towards a state funded public childcare system, which has been the policy of the Greens, I think, for quite some time, although they nuanced it a bit because, you know, financially, to do something like that would be a big transformative change. But I mean, the childcare budget has doubled under the Greens in government. And as somebody as a parent of a small child, I can see the benefits of that. I think a lot of people do. The ability to actually implement something like a state public childcare system is huge. How would you go from a private to a public system, given that so many people operate in the for-profit sector? But the Greens have said very clearly, well, it's in areas where there's not sufficient market provision of childcare. But the fact that the Fine Gael have moved in that direction, I think it also says something about the changing nature of the Irish electorate. There's a lot of people out there, graduates, you know, earning relatively good income, two people working, but they're not seeing the benefits of that income because, well, they're basically paying for a mortgage and they're paying for childcare, two mortgages. So I think there is a electoral demand for doing something on childcare, although it doesn't really show up in
it
public opinion
like there
data.
Has been for a long time, kind of bubbling under the surface.
Yes.
Like, you know, my generation, I remember
exactly.
We had two mortgages as well and we used to moan about it. But
this is where in political science we say, you know, political parties shouldn't just kind of respond to what public opinion is. It takes, political parties can create a niche issue. They can kind of put a wedge issue in place. And I think by focusing on childcare, it's very consistent with what you said a moment ago, Fine Gael positioning itself as standing up for that party for those who get up early in the morning, who have to send their kids to childcare. So I think it is quite consistent with a broader policy positioning of Fine Gael in advance of this election.
So they're centre-left and centre-right now. It's a bespoke kind of situation. Yeah.
As they always have been.
Yeah.
He was actually put to Simon Harris at the Think Inn in Tullamore on Wednesday by a journalist at the press conference that all this new focus on childcare was robbing and repackaging Green Party proposals, and I can't remember what exactly Simon Harris said, but I can tell you he was not at all impressed by this assertion that, you know, childcare has, you know, it's always been, he's always been worried about child poverty and does a child poverty unit set up, and then kind of Fine Gael sources saying afterwards, well, you know, Roderick O'Gorman is in favour of this, but we're in favour of doing it like this, and we're different because we're doing it like this. So that assertion was put to the Taoiseach, and I actually think it was kind of the strongest reaction he had to anything at that whole press conference, which is remarkable in and of itself.
Dan, any insights on the childcare thing, which has been this massive issue for people for decades now at this stage?
Well, I just want, we've had a collapse, as at many countries around the world, from Asia to Latin America, there's been a collapse in birth rates. People are just having far fewer children. So electorally, if you just consider it in that context, how many people in the electorate are actually affected by preschool kids? It's actually fallen a lot. So, you know, just from an electoral point of view, given how our birth rate and numbers of babies being born every year is falling at a rapid rate, how many people are being affected?
So it is, as Aidan said, a niche issue. I suppose the grandparents are Grandparents are affected as well.
And also,
people are having less kids, but not having no kids, right? So it means you might have less kids in preschool, not having no children in preschool.
Mm. I mean, it's also interesting, Fianna Fáil in this poll, again, saying that Fianna Fáil is growing support for the younger age group. I thought that was quite interesting there. And Fianna Gael seemed to be increasing support of the over 55. Mm. Now, we don't really know what's going on there. Is it a Jack Chambers effect? Mm. Or I don't quite know. But breaking down who votes, why they vote. And we've known this for years about, like, the Greig vote, for example, that, you know, older people vote. And that's one of the reasons, you can say, with a cynical hat, that's why people, you know, bring forward these policies before elections. So the age profile of these voters, particularly when we saw that rise in support over the last few years for Sinn Féin among your younger voters, it was an interesting trend there.
And it's been falling as well, which is really interesting. And also the support for Sinn Féin among the lower class voters is also falling, according to this poll in the Business Post. And I actually really like how the Business Post break it down. I think they provide really interesting insights of the kind of demographics of people who are supporting them. But it seems that Sinn Féin are kind of losing that traditional voting base. And I mean, how do you get that back if there's an election in 6 weeks' time? How do you get that back quickly?
Aidan, you take an interest in these kind of tectonic trends in different countries and everything. What's your assessment of what's going on there in terms of, are Fianna Fáil through some kind of car wash now and finding favour with a new generation with short memories? Are Sinn Féin, have they lost that generation? Was that it was a kind of a swell and now a fade?
Well, again, as Dan said earlier on, this is one, it's a snapshot in time. We have to look at these things over time. I think for Sinn Féin in particular, it's clearly part of a trend, and immigration is clearly the issue that has hit them hardest. And the fact that they have lost their largest vote share amongst lower income voters, which would be traditionally their core base, but if you push that a little bit further, it's their core base that lean to the right, basically, on immigration issues that they're losing. I suspect Ireland is going in the same way, the Dutchification of Irish politics, you might call it, the multi-party system. You have three or four parties that all hover around 15 to 20%. They all vie to lead party or coalition negotiations, and I suspect that's what's happening here. But if there is a consistent trend in Ireland compared to the rest of the European Union and other member states of the EU, also further afield in the USA, is that immigration is emerging as a wedge issue, and that is then forcing parties to compete on that particular issue. And Sinn Féin are the party that are struggling the
and
most with that.
And competing in a way that might not be their natural kind of political inclination, correct?
Exactly. And Sinn Féin, because they're quite qualitatively different to the rest of any other left party, let's say, across Europe, because, you know, they have this kind of nationalist thing. They are a working class party, if I can put it simply, and therefore we know comparatively the core base of their party has certain views on immigration that other parties across Europe that would be typically on the right would have. So they're stuck between that. But I think for Sinn Féin, it's a basic question of, do they go full on a progressive immigration stance, or do they go the opposite direction? And I think they're stuck between that. But we also know that it's likely that Fine Gael, and we know this comparatively as well, centre-right parties tend to do better when immigration emerges as an issue. And I think you can see that very clearly with Fine Gael. And as you said earlier on, because they've taken a stronger or tougher stance on questions of law and order in particular.
Just come in on that. We're seeing this play out in Germany, the biggest country in Europe. Immigration has just exploded as an issue there. And they have a coalition government. And I can tell you, the Irish coalition government seem to be best buddies compared to what's going on in the German coalition government. It is very fractured. But immigration, Olaf Scholz, the leader of Germany, is from a nominally a centre-left party, and he is having to come out now. They suspect they put up barriers at the borders with other European countries this week. It's a huge issue, and the left-wing parties are shifting to the right on that. So it's absolutely a trend we're seeing throughout Europe.
And Dan, AFD is not your standard kind of harmless far-righty kind of party. They seem to be a bit more actual far-right. People seem to be quite alarmed in Germany.
Yeah, I think that term far-right has kind of been debased by overuse, but the AFD, you know, given Germany's Nazi past, and some of these people seem to have a sympathy towards that party, which, you know, if you compare to
They're using language that hasn't been used in Germany in practically 100 years.
So that is clearly a worry. But on the thing of migration, you know, this has clearly become a major issue in every country. And people are saying that they're unhappy with the scale of immigration, as they are in this country. And if immigration returns as a big issue around in the general election, that's where I see things being really upended, because we haven't had, we're unlike any other country I know in Europe, we haven't had a discussion about what's the right level of immigration. Do we have too much immigration? And are there things we could do to lower the rates of immigration? Germany has started doing it now. Britain is doing it under a Labour government. It's standard practice. We haven't had that discussion.
So we're going to, we could end up in this election campaign having a surprise discussion that nobody has really thought through properly about immigration.
Because if you look at, opinion polls, big majorities of people are unhappy with the scale of immigration. Now, we can debate why that is, but that seems to be a fact. And the political system here has not addressed that. There is a real concern about anyone saying controlling immigration, oh, now we can't discuss that. The political system is going to have to sooner or later address the concerns of voters, and voters feel that there's too much immigration.
OK, just before we leave politics, Louise, the Mail on Sunday have a story that an early election could scupper Virgin Media's flagship show, Grow Air and Traw. Is that the...
Grow Air and Traw, which is the Irish version of Love Island. But this is quite an interesting little story in the Mail today. And basically it circles back to this idea of the celebrity candidate running for election. And as we know, Fianna Fáil selected Grainne Seoghaire to contest the election in Galway West. And the point of this article is that if, depending on the election time, this could spell trouble for Virgin Media, because Grainne Seoghaire is the host of this Grow Air and Traw programme, and that's meant to transmit from mid-October for 5 weeks, and because of electoral rules, because of broadcasting rules, October 14th. So if, because of broadcasting rules, no election candidate can have an unfair or, you know, excessive amount of coverage on the media. So would Virgin Media be able to broadcast this show if there's an early election? It's all kind of up in the air.
Oh no, they'll have to hold off the election until the new year then. It's
we'll
clear.
We'll see if Simon Harris will include that in his reasonings for wanting the election next year, which we also don't know if that's what he wants, because he wouldn't answer the question the other day, but here we are.
Okay. So obviously we have incessant talk about Apple and the Apple money again today. Dan, will you start us off? David Davenport, solid plan is needed to harvest Apple windfall. He's writing, voters don't care about reputation, in the Sunday Independent.
Yes, he's a really good columnist, a former reporter here at RTE. So he takes the view that the average voter doesn't care about our reputation in these areas, which I think is probably a good point. It does matter. I think Ireland's reputation has been damaged by this. There are plenty of people and politicians around the world, Europe in particular, that view Ireland as a tax haven, and this will strengthen that view that the highest court in Europe has found that Ireland did a sweetheart deal with one of the biggest companies in the world. That is definitely something that will have reputational damage. The average
aren't they bound to not like us getting all this corporation tax?
Are other people...
Other countries. Is that, like, is it, have we not accepted that as part of the bargain? Like,
well, up until now, there has been a view that Ireland has moved towards this OECD process of accepting other rules and doing things by
which
the
we book, have.
Which
cleaned
we have
ourselves up.
But at the same time, the amount... We are now getting sort of two Apple windfalls a year in corporation tax. And this is massively, this is pretty much all to do with multinationals moving money. So we've had this eightfold increase over the past decade from the low point in terms of how much we're taking in. We're probably going to take in about 26, 27 billion this year in corporation tax. So that's two Apple windfalls a year, and that's happening on a continuous basis. So we're becoming hugely dependent on this. This is a massive amount of money. I actually am, for the first time, beginning to think our foreign direct investment model has become too successful, and that in fact we could have, it's squeezing out indigenous business, it's making wages higher for indigenous businesses, that we've actually become too successful in this area.
And there is a suggestion going around about this money that it should be used to foster the growth of indigenous industry.
I was not sure that it's easy to do that. The best way to allow indigenous businesses is to reduce regulation where that's possible, to reduce the tax burden and allow businesses, rather than sort of proactively helping the state, helping businesses, to reduce barriers, costs on business. And that would be the area. And that's what I worry about, that the scale of success of this foreign direct investment model, the amount of money it's generating, the amount of people it's sucking in to work there, is having a negative effect on the indigenous business
base. That's a sobering thought. Aidan, are we a tax haven?
Yes, have been for 20 years. We could debate the specifics of what that means in the academic literature. Ireland is typically referred to now as a profit-shifting centre, given the change in the international rules whereby Ireland is a sink location for the intellectual property of big tech, big pharma, and the cost-sharing arrangements they have across different jurisdictions, typically linked back to the USA.
And is, so, this, is this judgment then so the beginning of a look at this profit shifting business like that? Like you're writing about it today in the Business Post. You are kind of suggesting that there might be an appetite for them to go back into our knicker drawer now and start looking for more stuff.
I think so. I mean, this is historic. It's huge. I mean, the European Commission had a lot of losses. They lost the Fiat case, the Starbucks case, the Amazon case. They were not able to use state aid rules to go after corporate tax abuse. And this was the biggest one. This is the biggest ever state aid case in the history of capitalist development, you could argue, right? And, you know, the specifics and the technical detail means that it is possible, and there's different ways to read this, and we could get into the weeds of that if you like, but there's two ways the Commission could go. They could begin to look back at previous historic particular deals, rulings that were done, and make the case that that was part of the Irish tax base, that it was effectively and ought to be allocated and taxed accordingly here. The bigger issue, which I have heard some tax lawyers, international tax lawyers, make the case this week, that actually the entire double Irish structure technically could potentially fall under illegal state aid now. Now, I don't think the Commission really has...
And just to point out to people, the double Irish has been gone for how long
now? It's been gone since 2015, but really 2020, because the Irish state gave 5 years for companies to basically get their house in order. So it's gone since 2020. But keep in mind that $1.5 trillion, right? There's a million millions in a trillion. $1.5 trillion has been shifted offshore over the 20-year period using that structure. So this idea that Ireland was not...
Using the Irish,
doing the double
structure,
Irish structure
alone.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this idea that Ireland wasn't a tax haven, it just doesn't wash anywhere outside the island of Ireland, right? When you know the technical detail. The issue here, though, is whether or not the Commission can use state aid to get at this, because they don't have the taxing authority or jurisdiction to tackle these questions.
And
they have
Creighton,
been successful in that.
Yeah. So Lucinda Creighton is making this point in her piece today, that basically they couldn't get at us through tax, so they're now using competition law basically to get at us. Tax is a national competency. She makes a point as well, and it's back to, like, do we care what people think of us? But she points out this, we can all get holy now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
This transformed the country, didn't it? It absolutely, the Ireland we are sitting and living in today, for all its faults, is basically built on probably the revenues from that.
Yes, yes. When tax has been the engine of the foreign direct and growth model for 20, 30 years, but I'm sure we'll get onto the conversation. That has probably exhausted itself now, right? But the point that Lucinda's making, and I don't necessarily agree with all of the article, but the question that she's asking, I think, is very important. And it gets, again, it's back to the technical detail on transfer pricing. But ultimately, does the European Court of Justice, has it overstepped its mark here, basically? Has it overstepped its legal right to effectively use previous judgments? So back then, Ireland didn't have very clear rules on transfer pricing. And the European Commission and the ECJ agrees, well, actually, do you know what? The EU had rules on that, and retrospectively, they should have been applied. So I'd say a lot of transfer pricing people in Ireland saying, oh, hold on a second here.
Just let's keep people here. Transfer pricing, this is the moving of profits and IP and stuff basically into stateless companies and this and that. Stuff that's sold elsewhere, being taxed here but not being taxed.
Very complex legal accounting that basically legal accountants sit down. How much is that IP worth? Where should we locate it? How much we pay you to use that? That's how this whole game is played, right?
Yeah.
So, but the point being, there could be a very strong argument that the ECJ and I has overstepped, and it'd be interesting to see. So, for example, this case has overridden the previous cases now, for example, Fiat. So it'll be remains to be seen whether or not going forward, the European Commission now sees this as an opportunity to really go after other countries and potentially to go after other users of the double Irish structure. We don't know. Possibly there's a new commission being set up, but it's an open question.
Yeah, and it feels like Margaret Vestager, who like basically was reputationally kind of destroyed by this in a sense and was a busted flush, cried when she heard it and is now like, I'm back and this is bad.
I mean, I was in Brussels this week when this was all happening, and it was a big deal, not just in Ireland, but across Europe, this case, because as you described there, Aidan, it's huge. It's the biggest case ever taken on this issue. Vestager is out the door. She's finishing her second term as a European Commissioner. They didn't think in Brussels that they might win this. So she has been vindicated in her strategy. Now, the big question, there's a couple of things here. a new commission is about to be sworn in. Who is going to get this important role in the next commission? That is crucial. And indeed, a lot of the big economic
and the role
portfolios.
Is, which role
Competition
is it?
Commissioner, essentially.
Yeah, okay.
So, and I mean, when we talk about the European Commission overstepping, etc., like this does get to the heart of the issue. I mean, the European Commission, people would say, Brexiteers would say, is not an elected body. It's not an elected body, but it can be very political when it wants to. So we can see that with the current French Commissioner, Breton. He's taken on the tech companies. You know, this is a personal political thing for him, and he's choosing to prioritise that. So whoever comes in now as Competition Commissioner, it's going to be very important. The other issue is and that
when you finish that, we go back to commissionership,
Make your other one other issue is that this issue of state aid, I mean, state aid is allowed in Europe. And at the moment, other countries are using state aid, number one being Germany, who at the moment is giving state aid to chip producers. Intel is in discussions with the German government about getting plants. Poland is giving state aid to Intel. That also should be a bit of a warning sign for Ireland in terms of these companies.
And they're at a level that we can't compete on that kind of state aid.
And this week also there was an important report by Mario Draghi, the Draghi report, and it's one of its many suggestions was that Europe generally has to increase its industrial capacity, you know, and loosen up the state aid rules to help that. And of course, smaller countries like Ireland would argue this puts them at an unfair disadvantage because the big countries with the deep pockets can then prop up their own.
Dan, do you have any observations to finish us up on that? And then I want to ask you, Louise, about how we spend the money situation.
Yeah, so there's been a radical change.
The real change.
The role of government in economies over the past, particularly since the pandemic, but it's been swinging back towards a more interventionist government. So back in the 50s, 60s, governments did a lot more in the economy. Then we went through this period where it was all free markets and government industrial policy was a bad idea. And particularly since the rise of China and its dominance in global manufacturing, there is an increase in insecurity because of Russia and because China is increasingly threatening. There is a view in both the United States, Western Europe, that we need to have we can't be as dependent on other countries. So this changes the landscape in Europe, where we had a very strong no subsidies to or very limited subsidies to business, where now everyone is shifting in saying there are good cases for subsidies to business. As Suzanne mentioned, that can be, and as you mentioned, that can be difficult for smaller countries that don't have the capacity to give big companies the tens of billions in subsidies. But we are in a very different environment. Final point, the European Commission is in a very difficult position here because as this landscape changes, its role will also have to change and how it deals with this. One thing I wouldn't be worried about, Aidan mentioned retrospective stuff going backwards. It has enough on its plate dealing with all of this. I don't see the European Commission
Thank God.
Back.
Okay. Thank God. I felt the conversation going in a very dark direction there. So, Louise, just to lighten it up before we finish up, people have much preferred to talk about the spending of the money. So John Lee in the Mail on Sunday, here comes the Apple election.
Yeah, and I think he's probably right. I think this is going to be a huge election issue, and different parties are out during the week saying that it will be in their manifestos what they would spend this 14 billion euro on. And I think we've heard a lot of this from the Taoiseach during the week, but John Lee as well saying in the Mail on Sunday today that you're going to be looking at spending the money on things like energy, telecommunications, water, housing, or as one person put
everything.
It to John, everything that's
the everything
really,
money.
Everything that's really screwed in this country. So that's one option. I think the other option that there also is, perhaps less sexy to the voters, is paying down the national debt, which, I mean, wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. I think the national debt is over something like 200 billion now at this stage. So 14 billion will be a chunk off it, but it's not as
appetizing. Paying down debts for the little people, Louise,
I think you'll find.
And John Lee makes the point that there'll be a budget, and then as a kind of an extra bump before an election, they'll announce then, and by the way, here's 14 billion more, and this is what we're going to do with it. Okay, we'll leave that there, and we'll take a break. Suzanne Lynch, Louise Byrne, Dan O'Brien and Aidan Regan staying with us. Welcome back, Suzanne Lynch, Louise Byrne, Dan O'Brien and Aidan Regan still with us. So Dan, there's a piece in the Sunday Times business section, Cormac Lucy, the fool in the shower can't stop the splashback from an American downturn. And maybe you could talk about this by way of giving us, we haven't seen you for some months now, so I'm always interested in your take on the economic outlook.
Yeah, well, Cuomo Gallucci is predicting a recession in the United States, and that'll blow back towards us. He may be right. It's a very difficult time to predict economics. This decade has been the craziest decade since COVID arrived and inflation suddenly appeared and interest rates soared. So it's been a very difficult time. I'm a more glass half full person. I think given if you had told me on New Year's Eve of 2019 that we were going to have all of those things, I thought we'd be in a depression of 1930 scale at this stage. So I think there's been an awful lot of resilience. That's been particularly the case in the Irish economy. Most indicators are showing that the economy is motoring along quite well. Things can always go wrong, but I just, unless something big, so, you know, there's talk about Russia going nuclear in Ukraine, we have something big like that, I would be reasonably optimistic that we will be chugging along okay for the next foreseeable future, six months out at least.
And in terms of the America and us catching a cold from that, what do you think the likelihood of that is?
Definitely, if the United States were to have a recession, it's our most important single economic partner. We sell more stuff to the Americans than any other single country. So that is a risk for us. And as I mentioned the last time I was on here also, that if Donald Trump were to be elected, he's advocating putting taxes on everything that goes into the United States. We sell four times more to America than we do to Britain. Now, if we had a tax on everything we sell, all those pharmaceuticals into the US, you know, we could have a Brexit scale shock. So that's another risk. So there are things out there, there always are, yeah. And it's unpredictable. But generally, I'd be reasonably optimistic in the short term that the economy is, if it's not struck by an external shock, things will continue reasonably well.
Of course, the other thing is if America starts slipping into a recession soon, Trump gets in, doesn't he? You would imagine. It's certainly going to help.
I certainly wouldn't predict the American general election.
But I mean, I think it would be a factor in things. Let's talk about something different entirely. Aidan, you picked David Quinn's piece in the Sunday Independent today about the paradox of church-run schools.
Yeah, I thought, again, much like the piece I mentioned earlier on by Lucinda, I don't necessarily agree with the overall conclusions of the article, but I think the right question is asked in the article. He's asking, look, we've had all of these scandals, we've had all of this abuse, but yet the Catholic Church still effectively run 90% of our schools, our primary school system. And why do we tolerate it? Has there not been greater demand for divestment? Why has the state not been more involved in trying to lead divestment? And he kind of puts it back to, well, is it really the case that people who, particularly in this part of Dublin, let's say South Dublin, who use a lot of these schools that are at the centre of a lot of these abuse inquiries, is it the case that if the state was to step in and say we're putting in a public ownership and we're changing the ownership structure, these are going to be state schools, not private schools, would the people who send their kids to those schools be happy or unhappy? And he's saying they'd be very unhappy and they're likely to resist it, right? So in a sense, it's a kind of underlying class politics that shapes a lot of these things. But I think it's an important question and I think it's an important debate that we need to have in Ireland. And we've not really had it. We've kind of let the church kind of just lead, try to divest. And I think, you know, it's something that we need to debate.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else?
I mean, there's a broader issue about the funding, the government funding private schools. Mm. That doesn't come up that often in Ireland, but I think is fundamentally problematic, particularly for left-leaning parties. They support that. In the UK, you know, private schools cost multiples more than they do here in Ireland because they don't have that same state subvention. I mean, to me, it gets to the heart of equal education. That's just something I feel strongly about. But again, I think there's no... The public aren't calling out for this.
Yeah.
You're right.
No, and like even in the political system, with everything over the last few weeks, there's been no broader discussion about the situation of those schools.
But I think where you will find people debating this is people who have experience of living in other countries, right? Mm. If you've lived in any other European country and you come back to Ireland and you're kind of experienced and exposed to this, you're like, oh, do I send my kids there? Oh, they're going to have to sit on their own because they don't want to do faith formation in school. I think the ridiculousness of it all, quite frankly, becomes real when you've experienced how school systems are run elsewhere and then you come back and you realise, well, actually the church still run the show here. Right?
Yeah, just on another education-related article, one of the most interesting articles I read in all the papers today was, I know it's pretty specific, it was about the number of non-EU students coming to Ireland. And now I'm not getting into the immigration side of this, but what it doesn't mention, the articles in the Sunday Times, is that, you would know this, Aidan, non-EU students pay a lot more money for fees, and they arguably are plugging this financial gap for universities. And in the UK, where they've seen a big increase in numbers of non-EU students, there's been a bit of a backlash towards that. We see the outgoing chancellor in Oxford warning, you know, just saying, for example, Chinese influence, for example, taking one example. So, we are now, according to these figures, huge numbers now are coming in to Ireland. You know, there are questions about the funding model and the kind of pressures that puts on it. And it, are non-EU students effectively doing what the state should be doing, which is funding higher education better?
I can tell you, as somebody who works in the university sector, that without the international student, non-EU student market, the university sector would effectively collapse.
Yeah. And that's not the right reason to have those numbers.
Okay. We were mentioning Trump there. Louise, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times by Justin Webb, 50 days shootout for president.
Yeah, this is a really interesting kind of, I guess, look back on the debate that was held during the week between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. And I guess a look forward at what exactly it is that they're going to have to do. And I guess when it comes to Harris, what Justin Webb was saying is, you know, it reminds him of the Obama campaign where, you know, it's energetic, it's, you know, it's joyful, but it's lacking in substance in some ways. And I think, you know, having watched the debate the other day, it was kind of easy to see that, yes, Kamala Harris, very impressive performer, but she didn't really answer actually a lot of the questions that were being put to her. But I think that kind of got overlooked because of, you know, Donald Trump sitting in the corner saying, well, they're eating the cats, they're eating the dogs, and all these kind of other mad utterances that he was making. And it's, I suppose, it kind of really focuses on what Kamala Harris is going to have to do, and that, you know, talking to voters in kind of these key battleground states, speaking to the media more about issues like gun ownership, which she spoke briefly about the other night, about fracking, about all these other things. And then in the context of Donald Trump, I guess it's really looking at the people who he had around him, who's advising him, who's, you know, really...
So there seem to be professional advisors, and then there's hangers-on who are in his ear. And the suggestion is this is where they're eating the pet stuff is coming from, the hangers-on.
Yeah, and I mean, if you looked at the eating the pet stuff, it was quite remarkable, because it was a discussion about immigration, and Kamala Harris started off with, well, look at who's at his rallies. There's no one at his rallies. People are leaving because they're bored of his rallies. And, you know, that was what annoyed him the most, when, you know, Kamala Harris has really been put in charge of the immigration issue by Joe Biden, and perhaps there's a lot of questions to ask about her action or her lack thereof in a lot of instances. Whereas you had Donald Trump going, I had the greatest rallies of all time. People love my rallies. No one's bored. They're eating the pets. And, you know, it kind of, all the substance
quality,
gets lost.
Quality stuff. Suzanne, you've kind of seen her up close in action, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah. When I was the Irish Times correspondent over in Washington, I was in part of the White House press pool that travels sometimes with the, I wasn't with the president, but I got to go with Kamala Harris as vice president and the first lady a bit.
Impressive.
So, yes, I mean, I always did. I mean, I have to say, though, I covered her on the original campaign, the first campaign, you know, 4 years ago. And she wasn't that impressive there, because she didn't know where she was in terms of this big debate that kind of tears the Democratic Party apart, which is how left-wing do you go? And she was flip-flopping on that issue.
Yeah, and she's regarded as having been way more wildly left-wing.
Yeah, but then other parts of her you know, now, you know, other parts of her background are her being tough on crime as this prosecutor. So, but now she's fighting a different battle. And I think she is, you know, she has a purpose. She doesn't have to worry about that as much anymore. So, I mean, on that time, I travelled her a few times. You know, she would brief the press kind of very on background, you know, and she was obviously very competent, very guarded, but very competent. I think she is, I mean, I think she's handled, I mean, it was a dream debate for her, because it was all about Donald Trump. And she didn't need to answer these policy questions. Now, you're absolutely right. Obviously, as everyone's saying, at some point she will. But does she really? If she keeps the focus on Donald Trump and he keeps doing this, you know, she is going to do very well. Now, of course, as we know, she has completely changed the race, but it's all about those swing states. I do think, though, that it's significant that she is making inroads with the younger voters. I was at the convention, the Democratic convention, feels like ages ago, last month. And what was really interesting, I noticed as a journalist, was that they had a whole section for influencers. So the traditional journalists, like my, you know, self, even though Politico is a more digital organisation, but
legacy,
we were kind of, So we were very much second class. So there was a lounge for them. We weren't allowed in.
Yeah.
They were doing live content, like really sophisticated stuff. And I thought the Democratic Party, I mean, Donald Trump, one of the reasons he won the election the first time was that he just commanded social media. He obviously used Twitter to bypass traditional media. So the Democratic Party are doing a lot of work on that, on the ground. Now, obviously, they'll need to reach those voters in the swing states like Pennsylvania.
Okay, and look, this is going to feed into people's calculus on Ukraine and what happens there as well, Dan. There's a really interesting piece by Mark Urban in the Sunday Times, and he is talking about, we haven't been allowed to talk about Endgame a lot, and anyone who suggested it was kind of, dismissed as a bad person. He's talking about that maybe both sides are getting tired and that maybe we need to start thinking about Endgame.
Well, there's a very good coverage in the Sunday Times on the war in Ukraine, which is, you know, by far the most important conflict for our continent now. It could get an awful lot worse. There's one article on the possibility of Russia using its nuclear weapons, which both Putin and people in Russia have been pointing to, including not-so-crazy people, a guy called Dmitry Trenin, who's an influential academic. So, you know, the stakes are extremely high here, and this could get an awful lot
worse. Conventional wisdom now among the rest of Europe seems to be that, look, he says this, but he's not going to do it.
I think that's probably correct, but, you know, the deployment of a nuclear weapon would be an absolutely game-changing thing, and it's a non-negligible probability, and anything that's as big as that, that there's any risk at all, you know, it at least has to be considered. Our continent has changed by this war. There's only one country in our continent that uses force against its neighbours, invades them, tries to tell them they can't exist, tries to decide how they should organise themselves, and that is Russia. If Russia wins this war, or is seen to win this war, it is not going to stop, and that is, view I very firmly take, and I think an awful lot of people take, that Europe just cannot afford, democratic Europe cannot afford to let the only country, and now militarily the single most powerful country militarily in Europe, to win a war that would threaten other countries. And that's where we're at. And it's a very serious situation. Hopefully there can be some sort of resolution brought about that Ukraine can accept and it doesn't escalate further, but that is a very real risk.
And you picked that piece too. Do you think that, could we be heading towards an end game now?
I don't know is the honest answer, but I think, again, the question that's being asked is important. I think we need to start talking about what does the end game look like here and look at it very realistically through a very kind of...
That people have to make compromises, Ukraine has to compromise on losing territory?
It's not my position, obviously, sitting here in Donnybrook to say a country should make a compromise,
but
I think military experts, those who are following this stuff very closely, I think are kind of focused on two things. Firstly, what would a long-lasting peace agreement or security agreement look like for Ukraine? Does that have to include some sort of secession of territory on the east, for example? Nobody I know or who I speak to who are experts on this stuff believe that there will be no territory lost in Ukraine, right? And I don't think we're being honest about that type of conversation. The Sunday Times has an interesting editorial to complement the piece, which is, look, we should call Putin's bluff and that we should allow Ukraine to use weapons to target inside Russian territory. And I think that is an important question because so far, the US, Europe, have basically been supplying Ukraine with sufficient amounts of ammunition, military support, to keep the war going, but not enough to actually win it. So even though on a normative level, I totally agree with Dan, absolutely we should be supporting Ukraine to win this. But what does that mean? That means Washington making very, very big decisions.
Yeah.
It means Europe making very, very big decisions to basically get directly involved. And nobody has been willing to take that step so far.
Okay.
So then the question is, well, what does the end game look like if you're not willing to take that big step?
I just want to take a minute, Dan, because you really want to mention Sudan. Could you just briefly tell us why we should be paying more attention?
Well, Sudan is a country the size of Ukraine in population terms. It has now what international organizations are talking about, the biggest displacement of people in the world. We've clearly seen the numbers of people who moved into Western Europe to pick up on the immigration point again, that there is a real risk. Not just, obviously, there's a humanitarian disaster going on. There's famine going on in Sudan on a massive scale. But also from our own perspective, there's the risk of a huge influx, another fresh influx of refugees. And in my view, we don't talk about this conflict nearly enough. including the implications it could have for all of us in Europe.
Yeah, and there's more chance of a resolution in Ukraine than there is in Sudan. I mean, half the neighbouring countries involved. It's a complete mess.
It's talks of genocide going on in that country.
Yeah. Okay, we'll take a break. Suzanne Lynch, Louise Byrne, Dan O'Brien and Aidan Regan staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel are still with us. Suzanne Lynch, Louise Byrne, Dan O'Brien and Aidan Regan. Now, we've been getting texts and emails from people on the way to the airport and at the airport and everything. Just to let people know, there is a power outage at Dublin Airport. The DAA has said that there are likely to be some delays today due to a power issue which has left more than 30,000 premises in North Dublin without power this morning. Parts of Terminal 2 experienced a loss of power earlier this morning, but the DAA says that most flight operations continued as normal throughout the incident. However, there are queues in the terminal, but DAA say those queues are easing now. Power has been fully restored to Dublin Airport and work is continuing to restore power to the other homes and businesses impacted. Okay. Suzanne, you picked a piece that's in the Sunday Independent by Julian Maloney. A Glimpse Behind the Mask, or a Masterclass in Marketing the Monarchy. And this is the video put out by the Princess of Wales this week.
Yeah, I couldn't help being drawn to all the royal coverage in the papers, despite myself. This was a very good piece because it's a very sensitive issue. You know, this is somebody who's recovering from cancer. And it was interesting seeing the British media response on this video that was released. It was a very slick, highly stylized video that the royal family released on social media, which itself is significant. No big announcement on the BBC. It was now social media during the week. And opinions are divided on it. Was it too stylized and produced.
Yeah, a lot of people mentioned it was the kind of thing that Harry and Meghan do. It had that aesthetic about it.
Yes, and of course this article is fantastic. It makes the point, for example, she's got the wholesome image of the family with no devices. They're all playing cards and they're sitting around a table chatting, even though the irony is, of course, most people are consuming this video through their own iPhones, that they're harnessing the power of the internet. And, you know, it was a complete change from the formality that would usually surround visual representations of the royal family that are highly curated. And I suppose I would agree with the final point that Julie Maloney comes to is that, they're trying to connect with these younger people about the monarchy. She and we forget this, she quotes a survey showing that only 37% of Britons aged 18 to 24 agree with the view that Britain should stay a monarchy. So, you know, you can see this many ways, but the point that they're trying to connect and meet people where they are, to use that phrase, is probably on balance a good idea by the future monarch.
Like Louise, if you put aside the content of it and just look at the message, the medium is the message we're told often. The medium here, this does feel like the royal family are going, okay, there's a new generation, a new era.
I just found the whole thing very odd, and I think, you know, the idea of the video, I think it was shown for something like 52 minutes on a loop on one of the English news channels during the week the day it was released. And I mean, I think perhaps is that half the point, that they want not only to get the social media crowd and that people are seeing it as they're going through X or Instagram or TikTok or whatever, but also that you're getting the older generation as well, and the ones that are watching the likes of Sky News or whatever channel it is that they're watching. But I mean, I think you're right. I think if Harry and Meghan had done something like this, they would have been absolutely pilloried, and you know, it would have been column after column after column about how they're moving away from the traditional values of the monarchy. And I mean, it was longer than it had to be. I mean, it's wonderful that Kate Middleton is doing well, don't get me wrong, but I just found the whole thing very almost voyeuristic, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, but look, she's damned if she doesn't and damned if she does.
True.
She was criticised for not talking about it. She felt terrible pressure, clearly, to come out and everything. And you know what, you would say as well that she did talk in that video about everyone else going through the cancer situation, and you know that she is with those people, and I think those kind of things do matter a lot to people. Okay, that our time's up. Thanks very much to my panel, Suzanne Lynch, Louise Byrne, Dan O'Brien and Aidan Regan. And just after 12 noon now, we'll go to the newsroom and Daniel Quinn.